This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. We've been at war in Afghanistan for nearly 20 years. The conflict has left more than 2,400 Americans dead. It's cost nearly $2 trillion, nearly a trillion dollars, pardon me. It's left 500,000 Afghans killed or wounded, and now that war might finally be coming to a close. Over the weekend, the U.S. signed a deal with the Taliban that lays out a timetable for the final withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan. But can we expect that timetable to hold? How reliable is the word of the Taliban? And above all else, is this really the beginning of the end? Our guests are going to help answer some of those questions. Professor Andrew Bacevich is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. He's also president of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. They're a foreign policy think tank. He served in the military for over two decades. He joins us from WUSF in Tampa, Florida. Andrew, thanks for being here.
Oh, glad to be with you.
Jennifer Glass is here. She's an international correspondent who's been covering the conflict in Afghanistan for nearly a decade. She joins us from Kabul. Jennifer, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Todd. Good to be with you.
And Jason Asaze joins us from Houston. He worked for several years as an interpreter around Afghanistan. He was born and raised in Afghanistan, and he currently serves in the United States Marine Corps. Jason, thank you.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be here.
Professor Bacevich, I'd like to start and get your reaction to the deal that Americans heard about over the weekend, a 14-month withdrawal timeline, a potential prisoner exchanges, and ultimately the removal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan after nearly 20 years. Is this a good deal?
Well, we use terms like deal or agreement to describe what's been signed. I think actually we ought to call it an aspiration because we have a heck of a long way to go before this yields anything that might be called peace. That said, I think the essence of what's going on here is this. The central war aim of the Taliban, which they have repeated over and over again, is to bring about the removal of foreign forces from Afghanistan. And they are now on the verge of achieving that. Our aims have been varied. They included defeating the Taliban, which we've not done, but they included creating Afghan security forces that were able to defend their own country independently. We've fought corruption. We've tried to reduce opium production. We've tried to create a legitimate and effective Afghan government. And we have accomplished none of those. So Taliban representatives have described this turn of events as victory on their part. And I have to say, I think that's a fairly accurate description of where we are.
Jason, I'm interested in how you hear that assessment, especially given your connection to Afghanistan and your current role serving in the U.S. Marine Corps. If it's not a deal, if it's an aspiration, and the United States, as Professor Bacevich said, has not achieved its varying aims, that moving target over the years, what do you think we get from this?
I absolutely agree with Professor Bacevich. The Taliban do see this as a victory. In fact, if you pay attention to some of the media in Pakistan, and then, you know, some of the media outlets by Taliban themselves, they actually yelled Allahu Akbar, God is great, right there in the hall where that agreement was being signed. They do see this as a form of victory for themselves. For the U.S., you know, we wanted this initially. We wanted them to hand over bin Laden and you know, stop cooperating with Al-Qaeda. And we could have done this like in 2001, and we would stop all, you know, the blood feud and the war and the conflict and suffering that the Afghan people went through. Taliban could do this early on as well, but even now they haven't really lost anything. As far as how much it will hold up later, I'm very skeptical about all that, but at this time, it looks like Taliban are actually getting the better end of this deal.
All right, Jennifer, let's hear from U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper. He was speaking on CNBC. He was asked this question of whether he would call this deal or this aspiration with the Taliban actually a victory.
You know, I'm reluctant to call things victories or losses, but I think it's the way forward. It enables us to reduce our footprint, our presence in Afghanistan going forward. I think it's most important for the Afghan people. They've been in constant warfare for decades. I think they deserve better than what they've had.
Jennifer, what does that statement from the defense secretary mean? I mean, it's striking. Usually in a situation like this, you would expect the U.S. government to find a way to claim victory. The defense secretary isn't doing that, merely calling it a way forward. It's extremely ambiguous.
And I think the deal itself is ambiguous, and by design. The Taliban definitely are calling this a victory and a sense of what they're doing. Their military commission issued a statement to their fighters today, telling their fighters to start attacks again against Afghan security forces. Now, this is after a reduction in violence that went on for 9 days. It was a precondition for the signing of the deal on Saturday. And Afghans were cautiously optimistic, very excited. This is the longest period of quiet this country has seen in many, many years. Civilian and military casualties slowed to a trickle in this past week, but just today we're seeing an attack in Host Province, a bombing near a soccer field that killed 3 civilians and injured 11. And Afghans are very worried. They know that their government has not had a hand in this deal, and they're kind of watching and waiting. They knew something had to move. The Taliban and the United States had fought to a stalemate, but as usual, in the middle have been Afghan civilians, and they are hoping that maybe this deal will nudge things forward.
Andrew Basevich, what does that mean, what Jennifer is reporting there, that the Taliban is already calling in certain parts for renewed attacks, that even the timeline for this week-long truce might not be holding? Is that a show of force to say the Americans are leaving no matter what they do, or suing for another platform to negotiate again? What do you make of it?
I don't know. I mean, we have sort of a limited data set here. I think it's always important to remember that, you know, wars are messy. It is not necessarily the case that every Afghan fighter is somehow following the dictates of central authority. I have to say, my general expectation would be that the interests of the Taliban would be best served if they kept quiet, if they behaved, and therefore allowed the Trump administration to follow through on its clearly stated determination to get out of Afghanistan. I mean, this is where I think the domestic American political context figures. Ever since Trump was running for president, he has denounced our endless wars. He's promised to end them. And here, as we approach the 2020 presidential election, Afghanistan provides him with the best opportunity to make good on that promise. And therefore, if the Taliban would just sort of sit on their hands for a while, they would in fact win this victory that they are claiming is theirs. The Americans will leave.
Khalid sent us this email. There's no question about the Afghan people wanting peace. Yes, they do. Yes, we do. This deal sounds like a win for America in the short term, like a win for the Taliban, like a bad foundation for negotiation between the Taliban and the Afghan government, and a betrayal to the Afghan people. That comes to us from Khalid. Jason, you still have family in Afghanistan. What have they been telling you about the ceasefire and how they feel about this deal, this aspiration?
Yes, I do. Actually, my parents and my siblings still live in Afghanistan. They're very skeptical because Taliban, I've personally lived through their regime, and I know what it felt like being deprived of really basic human rights, like not being able to listen to music. You know, now that's very basic, and it's very fundamental. We couldn't even do that. So with the memories that we have from the Taliban, And from their track record, they cannot really be trusted. The Afghan people, they don't feel like they have any guarantees from this agreement. Now, given that we may get something out of this or we may not, it's not a guarantee that it will naturally go to the next phase and then to the next, and we will have a ceasefire and the violence. So they're very skeptical, especially with the Afghan government being kind of left out of this whole agreement. So this is more like a win-win situation for President Trump. He can use it as a campaign point. He can take credit for ending the war and bringing troops back home. And it's a victory point for the Taliban for saying that, yes, we were finally able to force the U.S. to get out of Afghanistan, whether that was by diplomatic means or through war, you know. That's the reality of it. We are getting out of there. And have we accomplished anything humanitarian? Yes, we have. But with bringing Taliban back, it's all going to be in a very unknown situation. And we won't know if it will last any long.
Jennifer Glass, let's back up a moment and talk about the terms of this deal, or this aspiration, as we're calling it this hour. One of the headlines that Americans may have heard is the agreement to a prisoner exchange, the release of 5,000 Taliban fighters from custody as part of this truce, part of the early parts of the deal. Bring us up to speed on the bullet points here.
So I think this is a real point of contention, and it's become a real issue here in Kabul over the last days. Now, the agreement between the Taliban and the United States says that the United States will work on a plan to reduce up to 5,000 political and military prisoners. Those are Taliban prisoners, and that the Taliban will release up to 1,000 Afghans held by the Taliban by the 10th of March. Now, the Taliban have seized on this and said they want all 5,000 released before the talks can begin on the 10th of March. The Afghan government, which of course was not a party to this agreement or the negotiations, and who hold these Taliban prisoners in their custody and see them as a leverage point for negotiations, have said this was never agreed, and this is actually something for the intra-Afghan talks. And then the Taliban apparently telling the Reuters news agency today that if all 5,000 aren't released, then we will not have these talks at all. This is the kind of stumbling blocks. This is the kind of back and forth I think we're going to have. The Taliban, one of the Taliban leaders in Doha, when asked about this by an Afghan journalist on Saturday, said, "What if the government doesn't release the prisoners?" He says, "We don't recognize the Afghan government. We didn't talk to the Afghan government. They're not an entity for us. It's the Americans' responsibility to do this. The Americans guaranteed us that they would do this." And I think,
Jennifer,
this is
that gives the difficult impression then. I mean, the Americans must have known this, that any deal that excluded the Afghan government would be rickety at best. And that then sort of betrays an intention, perhaps, and I might be overshooting the mark here, that negotiating only with the Taliban, leaving out local stakeholders, leaving out the Afghan government, leaving out the voices of ordinary Afghan youth. We got one email, one tweet that said voices of local and ordinary Afghan youth, Afghan women, have been glaringly missing from this deal. That all may be true, and it seems to suggest that the American intention here is to pull the ripcord no matter what and leave Afghanistan to its fate.
Exactly. And that is the big concern. And as the Taliban and the United States were signing this deal in Doha, Secretary Esper was here, as well as Jens Stoltenberg, the head of NATO, to assure the Afghans that there is a long-term commitment to the and they signed their own declaration trying to push that forward. But there is a big concern. What you say is absolutely true. Afghans and the government have been very resentful that they have not been part of these agreements. And they felt that now that this was signed, perhaps these intra-Afghan talks would finally let them move forward. And it's unclear whether the intentions of the Taliban were ever to truly have these talks. They have always said they don't recognize the government. And in their military order today to the fighters, they call the Afghan forces, the puppet Kabul administration, as they always have. So I think it is a huge concern. Now, whether the United States entered into this because they felt it was the best they could get, the Taliban have consistently refused to talk to the Afghan government. And so they felt that this is the way to this was the way to jumpstart it. I don't know. It really is, as Jason said, many Afghans are wondering, what is going to happen next? Can you trust the Taliban? Have they really changed? It was a brutal regime when it was here. And many are concerned that if they are left abandoned by the international community, that it could get worse again.
Jennifer, we have just a couple of seconds. We're going to take a break. But what about the strength of the Taliban right now? It's one thing for them to say they're not talking to the Afghan government or they'll still go at them. Have we weakened their ability to threaten the government in Kabul? Do we have any expectation that they could return and take over significant parts of the country?
Well, during their fighting, while they control or contest half of the country, none of them are population centers. None of them are big cities. They've never been able to really fight their way into a big city. They briefly held Kunduz in the north for a very few days. But this is what military leaders believe, that they were at a military stalemate and the people who were really suffering were the civilians.
That's Jennifer Glass, a journalist live from Kabul in Afghanistan, covering the war in Afghanistan. Also speaking with Andrew Basevich, a contributing editor to Harper's, president of Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And Jason Asaze, he's a former U.S. military interpreter, a current enlistee in the United States Marine Corps Reserves. More on the U.S. deal or aspiration in Afghanistan coming up, including the way forward and where it might end. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Warby Parker, creating boutique-quality eyewear. Warby Parker offers eyeglasses, sunglasses, and now contacts, including Scout, their very own comfortable, breathable, and affordable daily contact lens. Every Warby Parker frame includes custom-cut, scratch-resistant lenses with UV protection and anti-reflective coating at no additional cost. Try on 5 frames at home for free at warbyparker.com/1A.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle so you can share what you know. On the News Roundup, find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Don't you feel better when you're prepared? Well, with the spread of the coronavirus, this is a good time to make a plan. I'm Allison Aubrey. NPR's Life Kit has a whole episode on what steps you can take to protect your family. Listen and subscribe to Life Kit.
Back now to our conversation on the Afghanistan peace deal with international correspondent Jennifer Glass in Kabul, Professor Andrew Basevich of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. They're a new think tank in Washington, D.C. that's backed by the Koch Foundation and the Open Society Foundation. And Jason Asaze, he served as an interpreter in Afghanistan. He's currently enlisted in the United States Marine Reserves. Andrew Basevich, I'd like to play another voicemail from another service member, one of our listeners. Take a listen.
My name's Travis. I'm in Denver. I was in Afghanistan from October of 2010 till May of 2011. While I was there, we had a really successful deployment with only one KIA. It was really, really good deployment. After we left, nothing's ever changed. We still have people coming back and forth, and this is 10 years ago. And it's made me wonder what their whole purpose of being in Afghanistan was. And I sort of think of it like a risk board. Afghanistan is in the middle, right next to Russia and China. So at a moment's notice, we can fill that place with American forces. And that's what I've always thought that Afghanistan is really about.
Travis, thank you so much for sharing your story with us and for your call. Andrew, what do you make of that? You mentioned at the top of the show the moving target of the American objective in Afghanistan, that Afghanistan forces, security forces were supposed to stand up and be able to fight. We were supposed to fight corruption. We were supposed to shut down opium. We were supposed to stand up a functioning government. None of that has happened. And from the perspective of one of our warfighters in Afghanistan, we've heard from several of them so far questioning why we were there in the first place or what it was all about. How did this target continue to move? Why was the United States never able to formulate one cohesive strategy and stick to it?
Well, that's a crucial question, and I think there's no easy answer. But I think one partial answer relates to the prevailing mindset within our political establishment in the immediate wake of 9/11. And this conviction that the United States possessed a military instrument that was simply unstoppable, and that therefore we could enter a country like Afghanistan in 2001 and a country like Iraq in 2003, sweep aside the existing political regime, and install in its place a new political order, more to our liking, and perhaps even more consistent with our own values. So we've tried this a couple times. Obviously, hasn't worked. It's not clear to me that people in Washington have come to terms with what I would argue are the lessons. And the central lesson to my mind is that the purpose of the United States military should be limited to defending and deterring. And this notion of putting the troops to work to bring about massive radical political change in countries that we know little about should never happen again.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll hear more from our guests and from you in just a moment. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is 1A.
You might know Nick Kroll from his very raunchy animated show on Netflix, Big Mouth.
Are you the puberty fairy?
The puberty fairy? I'm the hormone monster. I'm not a fairy.
Well, now he's starring as a romantic lead in a movie set at the Olympics. Actor and comedian Nick Kroll. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. Back now to our conversation on Afghanistan. And we got this message via Facebook from Jason, who says, I've been to Afghanistan several times as recently as last year. In fact, first as an infantryman and now as a special operations soldier. And in my experience, we are making some progress, albeit slowly, and we're light years from when I started deploying back there in 2005. We're currently in Iraq 3.0 due to hastily politically made decisions, and I worry that we'll do the same in Afghanistan. It will take more blood and more treasure to undo what damage is done in our absence. And Jason Asaze, that suggests from another Jason who's been in Afghanistan that maybe we shouldn't be leaving. Maybe we should stay until the job is done, as hard as that is. It's almost difficult to remember why we were there in the first place. In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, because the Taliban were harboring al-Qaeda forces and Osama bin Laden. And here we are 2 decades later. Jason, what's your assessment of the moving target of the mission and whether it really is time to leave?
So we have come a long way. You know, we've achieved great things there. For instance, in my own life, when I was growing up in Afghanistan and it was during the Taliban, I actually went to school under a tree. We had a blackboard and chalk, and we would study under a tree. Now, that's almost completely rare in Afghanistan. You would not find a school like that anymore. So we have schools. Women are able to go back to work. They're able to go to school. They're able to be employed, you know, and you can listen to music. So we have a lot of freedoms there. We have made a lot of changes. The Afghan government is strong. Yes, it will take a long time before Afghanistan is at a point where they can hold their own. I don't know. Is the cost too much on us right now? Can we not afford this? How long can we stay there? This is all, you know, part of the things that I cannot talk about. I don't know if we can sustain the same cost and then keep on moving Afghanistan forward little by little. Mm-hmm. But as far as progress, we have made a lot of progress, and we are so much ahead of what it used to be like in 2000, won, or, you know, in the late 90s, we've made a lot of changes. And something that I would like to weigh in here, Taliban are proxy forces for the Pakistani military. They are proxies for the Pakistani military. So they, even if there is peace in Afghanistan, it will not be a free Afghanistan. And that's what most Afghans look at it. You know, they look at it that way. They see that, okay, we will be ruled by Pakistanis in some way, indirectly. And most Afghans, they will tell you it's much better to be in an agreement or in cahoots with the U.S. than to be with Pakistan, you know? So, and there are different factors to the whole conflict, and some of them, they haven't really been seen as a factor by the Western media, or, you know, the politicians, which is the tribal factor. Afghanistan is a very tribal country. The Taliban insurgency is actually fueled by tribalism, and the more that we get into it, we seem to forget about that, and we think that this is a political movement. It may be a political movement, but it's also very tribal.
Let me bring Jennifer in on this question. Jennifer, you're in Kabul. We talked about the strength of the Taliban across the country, functioning mostly in more rural areas. How strong is the central government, and how prepared are they for some of the realities in Afghanistan, if not simply the strength of the Taliban, the power of tribal, what we used to call warlords, and the power of Pakistan to Afghanistan's south to meddle and influence their affairs?
The government here is very aware of the power of Pakistan, and has spent the last 5 years trying to mitigate it, really. The port in Chabahar, so there's a deep water port in Iran. You know, Afghanistan suffers from the fact that it is a landlocked country. And so in order to get things in and out, you must go through your neighbors. And that makes it very vulnerable to its neighbors, and Pakistan has taken great advantage to it. And until just a couple of years ago, the only water access Afghanistan had was through Pakistan. But now it has a deep water port in Chabahar and trade through Chabahar in Iran, which gives it more options. President Ghani has opened air corridors to China and India to try and get some of the goods out. You have a whole generation of young people here in Afghanistan that never knew the Taliban, that have heard about them from their parents, but are in university now and weren't born when the Taliban fell, or were tiny children when the Taliban fell. A senior Afghan official commented the other day to me. He said, look, 5 years ago, most of the ministries were really run by Westerners, were run by Western advisors who really ran things, even though there were Afghans in charge. And now they're really run by Afghans. So I think Jason is right. A lot of strides have been made here, and a lot of movements have been made forward. It's very difficult to build a country from the ground up. And Afghanistan is a difficult country anyway in terms of its topography and terrain. It is mountainous. A lot of things are very remote. We have seen the Taliban over the last couple of years ramp up its efforts to collect taxes across the country. I know that they have been asking NGOs to hire some of their people as well. So the Taliban has been trying to be able to paint itself as a government of its own. It has shadow governors. It has its own justice system. It has its own NGO committee. And as I said, it does collect taxes. And so that is really what the central government, the Republican government, the central government in Afghanistan is going to be fighting against. I think the Taliban are going to try and present themselves as an alternative.
Andrew Basevich, last December, The Washington Post published an investigative report. It was called The Afghanistan Papers, and that was an allusion to the famous Pentagon Papers from the Vietnam era. The papers this time in question, they were a series of tapes and transcripts showing that some of the war's main architects were criticizing the whole venture, talking about ways to whitewash and cover up the extent of the failure in Afghanistan. I mean, strikingly reminiscent of what went on during the Vietnam era. Here's a clip from one of the tapes. This is Lieutenant General Michael Flynn
describing military leaders who would hear all this positive spin about Afghanistan and then eventually go to the country themselves.
And then they come back and they go, man, this is really bad. But yet the last battalion and the last regiment or BCT that you just replaced, they said they accomplished their mission. They got all these wonderful stats about what they did. But the next guy that shows up, and I'm telling you, this is from 2002 until today, okay? So somewhere along our system, and this includes the State Department, ambassadors, you know, local, down at the local level, everybody did a great job. We're all doing a great job. Really? So if we're doing such a great job, why does it feel like we're losing?
Andrew Bacevich, you've written recently that America is essentially addicted to wars, and that's a critique that was around at the time of the Pentagon Papers, too. You hear Michael Flynn talking about the experience of American officials pumping up war, going to Afghanistan, learning the exact opposite, and the American public largely is none the wiser. It makes me wonder why we're having this conversation now and not 10 years ago.
Well, I think one of the things he's describing is sort of the can-do spirit of the American military. And there's something admirable about that. You know, give me the job and I'll get it done. But what those Afghanistan papers showed, they showed many things, is that there really has been no serious accountability. The battalion commander who, you know, reports upon his arrival that everything screwed up and that when he departs, everything is going well. There has not been an adequate, I should say, effort to see the larger context. You know, to my mind, one of the nexus of this conflict, the best explanation for its duration has to do with the fact that the existence of foreign forces in Afghanistan is viewed by the Taliban as simply unacceptable. And as long as foreign forces remain, resistance will continue. I mean, this harkens back to the experience with the Mujahideen and the Soviets back in the 1980s. Their aim was to get the Soviets to leave. The aim of the Taliban is to get the Americans and the other foreigners to leave. And until they achieve that, then the war is going to continue. Another important thing that's changed, I think, over the course of the last 15 or 18 years has to do with the evaluation of the importance of Afghanistan as viewed from the United States. Jennifer commented about how Pakistan sees Afghanistan as a vital interest, and they will remain determined to ensure that Afghanistan is friendly to Pakistan. We don't have that kind of interest in Afghanistan. We're ready to leave. We are, in a sense, back where we were with the Vietnam War in 1972. We're looking for a decent interval. We're looking for an agreement that will enable us to pull the plug, and then it's going to be up to Afghans to determine their own future.
The echoes and the memories of Vietnam, Professor Bacevich, we got to go, unfortunately, but I think it's critical what you just said, the echoes and the memories of the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam present today as the United States announces a deal, an aspiration for withdrawal from Afghanistan after two decades of war. That's Professor Andrew Bacevich, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. We also heard from Jason Assaze, who served as an interpreter in Afghanistan, and Jennifer Glass, international correspondent based in Kabul. Thanks to you all. This conversation was produced by Paige Osborne and Gabrielle Healy and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the website at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.